So hi, my name is Emmanuel Levy, and I'm interested mostly in protein and how proteins organize inside a cell, and that includes organization in terms of conservation, as we are going to see here, but also in organization in terms of interactions, how basically proteins see each other, and how that influences the cell. So so today's talk, this morning's discussion will be about protein evolution. So I think it's going to be quite different from what we've heard so far, in the sense that it's not here. I'm not going to ask why is a particular amino acid in a protein conserved and another amino acid not conserved, but why are some proteins in a protein conserved and other proteins not conserved? And you kind of have already a hint at what is important. It's cellular concentration. You can see in the background of these slides a symbol of Republicans and Democrats, and that's because I think there could be another title to this talk that could be story of Republicans, Democrats, and money. That would make it maybe more appealing to you all. All of this work has been carried out by Benjamin, who's a master student in the lab, we've been working together for quite a while now. So why is concentration the main determinant of a protein's evolution? I thought I should start first by linking this talk to the topic of this course, which is about evolutionary cell biology. We've seen many pictures of beautiful protists. I thought I would also show one, except this is from a French person. It's Jacques Monod. When he gave his Nobel lecture on symmetry and function, he described these forms of life that are symmetric, and basically how life is symmetric and beautiful. So that's my contribution to the to this set of nice pictures. But I guess more generally, I think what really this talk is about is understanding how what is the relationship between these two spaces, the genotype space and the phenotype space, but how life navigates or drifts within that space. I think it doesn't navigate randomly, or it doesn't drift randomly. I mean, the mutations themselves are random, but the selection is not random. And so that's really this non-randomness that I would like to discuss. Another way to put it, you have a species, say, at time t, and you have chance mutations. And at time t plus 1, you now have some mutations are fixed. The big question is, are all genes equally likely to accept mutations? And of course, as you probably all know, the answer is no. So the question is, why? We know that some genes, like here it's a myosin regulatory protein, some proteins are extremely well conserved. So here, from human to, say, elephant or ferret, you can see that you have few point mutations. Here you have conservative mutation, a bit less conservative mutation, but overall it's extremely well conserved. On the other hand, you have other proteins. So this is HMG protein. So you can see that here you have, even within blocks, you have lots of mutations, and you also have many insertions, as well as probably deletions. So you can see that these two proteins evolved for the same amount of time, but one is super conserved, the other one is not. So the question I would like to ask is there one general driving force that can explain this dichotomy between the Republican and the Democrat? Actually, it's not really this analogy that I would like to use a politics for. But okay, so I would like to ask a series of questions that I hope would resonate with you and make you think about this question in perhaps slightly different ways, and that would make it more interesting. So this is basically, why are some mutations more acceptable than others? Is there a universal mechanism that shapes the way in which protein and thereby cells and organisms evolve? In other words, if you have an organism, so we have seen that beautiful diversity, if we could replay the movie of evolution, are there like universal like mechanisms that would still drive similar Would the pathway in which the genes have evolved be somewhat similar if we could replay the movie of evolution? That's really a question that is kind of at the core of this talk. And another way to see it is there an optimal way to explore the phenotype space? In other words, let's say tomorrow you want to create an artificial organism by yourself introducing mutations. Should you just do random mutagenesis, or should you focus on specific genes to have a higher chance to achieve a viable evolved organism? That's another way to see problem. So, I mean, all these are questions. The talk is not very long, so if you would like to contribute anything, you should just contribute to the discussion. So, yes?
What do you mean by an optimal way?
An optimal way, meaning, optimal way is maybe it's kind of too deterministic, I would say. Here, I would assume that that will not please Mike, but that the evolution usually follows if the evolutionary landscape is kind of an energy landscape, I would imagine that organisms follow the path of lowest energy. They don't, it would be very hard to climb a mountain, meaning that to accumulate a lot of mutations, that where each mutation is deleterious, and the sum of the mutations would be advantageous. You see what I mean? So each mutation in itself will kind of not make you drift very. It's kind of most mutations are neutral. That's what it means. But then the way in which you drift is always in a way where you remain optimized for the conditions where you live. It's not clear.
I don't like the word optimization.
It's not optimal to use optimal.
What about like a mesa? I mean, it sounds to me like you're sort of.
Sorry?
You're more describing a sort of mesa or tabletop.
What?
If you imagine the adaptive landscape is chopped off and you don't care about getting to the optimum, but you're in the high, you're high enough so you're essentially neutral or nearly neutral and moving along. Would that go within your?
Yeah, of course. I'm not talking about an absolute optimality. I'm just saying, I think the analogy of de novo, if we want to artificially change an organism. So let's say you want to change an organism from mitosis with a closed nucleus versus open nucleus. So let's say you want to do that, you want to engineer that. So what proteins should you mutate? Are there some proteins that will not be optimal to mutate in the way you want to force the organism to evolve? That's what I mean. So first, a natural intuition would be that you don't want to mutate any protein that if it's not functional in the organism will die. These proteins, typically you really don't want to touch them, for example. So that could be.
Put preferred.
Yeah, I would gladly change optimal to preferred.
and Emmanuel, in the example you gave, where let's say you had an engineering challenge, which was you wanted to change some cell physiological feature, open versus closed mitosis. Would you say then why not focus on the proteins that if you know the proteins that are involved in that process?
That would probably be a good starting point. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Okay, but that's different than.
Yes.
That's not the money you're talking about here.
No, not exactly. But I mean, I agree that would probably be the way to go. It's probably not the best engineering experiments to describe.
Why do you need a mono export?
Sorry.
Why do you even have this fundamental desire to search phenotype space, right? If you've got the
phenotype, then
it's just a load
on
the population to go
exploring. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood that
really. Well, I guess we're dancing around the word optimal now, but you're still wanting to explore phenotype space.
Yes.
So what is the underlying reason for wanting to do that? That assumes that there's assumes a lot of things, but one is that you know there's something else out there to be looking for.
I mean, there's always something out there to be looking for, I guess. I mean, organisms, I mean, we constantly explore the phenotype space within the population, across species.
I mean, mutations happen. But
yeah. But
so organisms aren't designed to.
They are not.
Around populations are designed to go looking around the phenotype space.
I agree. I agree. I didn't formulate.
Next slide.
Sorry? Yeah. I mean, so I guess what I want to say is that if we can understand what constrains the evolution of a proteome, we will better understand the pathways through which the proteomes basically explore the phenotypic space. I mean, of course, they don't explore it because they are meant to explore it, they just explore it because they just do. But the thing is, the question is this exploration random or not random? I think I could even just say, is there a non-random way? I mean, that's even like more general than preferred. Okay, so.
It just said random, I just want to be clear. Do you mean that it's a biased process, or do you really mean non-random?
Not at the mutation level, at the selection level. So are some proteins more likely to accept mutations, and if so, for which reason? Or if not, for which reason as well?
There is a body of thought, not represented in this room, but a sizable, I would say, body of thought that argues that organisms are adapted so that populations are evolvable. There are people that say that develop theories about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, I'm just trying to let everyone know that, in case they don't.
So,
evolvability, this is going to go down the drains.
So, there's no evolvability, I think, in this talk, even though I'm very interested in the question.
It sounds like a lot of people are reacting.
Sorry?
It sounds like what evolvability.
I
mean, you could argue that the system has evolved in a place where few mutations can have large impact while not being deleterious. I mean, yeah, one could argue that as well, but it's not the focus. It could be interpreted in that way, perhaps, but I would say it's not the focus.
But there are people invited that are coming to the cell biology workshop that do argue this evolvability.
I sometimes do
it. Well, have their chance.
Yeah.
So,
not many.
I think my gave you wise advice.
Yeah, I think it's okay.
You can come back to that slide.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good. The goal of these questions was to trigger the discussion. So glad it did. So the talk will be mostly in two parts. So this is outline one. In the first part, I will review the part of the literature, small part of the literature about protein evolution, and show you what people have done. And in the second part, I'll show you some of our results that mostly contradict what everything we know. So first, let's go back one step and not even focus on concentration, but just ask what could the consequences of a mutation be in terms of one could ask this question at the level of the protein itself, at the level of the organism. So would you like, what would be your thoughts? What would be the most expected impact for a random point mutation? In terms of the.
Say the question again.
So let's say you are a protein and you just acquire a point mutation. The question is the question is what to expect for that protein and for the organism where the protein is produced.
Can you explain what are the colors?
No, this is just to illustrate that you have a protein and there is a point mutation. I'm not sure what is the green and blue. This is just purely illustrative. So, I mean, one could expect that nothing happens to the protein, neither to the protein nor to the organism. One could expect a change in function. One could expect through a change perhaps in stability. One could expect that the organism will die because that protein now is unstable and say will misfold and the function cannot take place. One could expect that this interaction, this mutation will create a new protein-protein interaction. One could expect that this mutation, if it was in an enzyme, could change the catalytic activity. I mean, one could expect many things. I'm not sure if you have any other idea of what we could expect. Nope. Okay. So I tried to think about it, and I thought that one could distinguish between two types of effects. What the direct effects, one could call them the cis effects on the protein itself, which would be structural changes, loss of binding to a partner. So that would be direct effect on the protein. And one could expect also indirect effects on the cell. So that I would like to call these a trans effect, where say you have creations of new molecular species. That could be a new misfolded species. It could be a new interaction. It could be a new promiscuous catalytic activity that will create a new small molecule in the cell. And also, say, if the protein has to be produced in higher amounts, as Dan showed us actually in the talk, that could also contribute to the cost of production. So, yeah.
I don't see those as being necessarily separate categories. So, for example, you have binding in both categories, which seems a bit strange to me.
So, yeah, so that's the misinteraction would be so that would be the creation of something, that would be the creation of a new molecular species. That's what I mean here by misinteraction, whereas this would be the loss of an existing interaction. That, I mean, yeah, but I agree, it's quite blurry. I spent a lot of time trying to kind of, because clearly the creation of a new molecular species is not a direct effect. So I think one could, I mean, I...
Why is that not a direct effect?
The molecule is doing something. I mean, it followed in one. I mean, it had a set of conformations in one case, and it's got a set of conformations in the second case.
So, I mean, I agree that what here a structure. I mean, here the loss of stability can cause the misfolding. I mean, so these two categories here. It's just to distinguish because people study the impact at different levels. So even though the source can be the same, the source is always a point mutation, the source can be a loss of stability that can create misfolding, but in one case, someone will focus on, say, a protein that lost its function, and in another case, someone will focus on the new molecular species that is being created, which is a misfolded species. So I think it's a matter of...
Aren't you really just talking about loss of function effects or gain of function effects, you're asking in the first, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a useful category, I'd be curious to see where you go with this, but isn't the first that you're talking about loss of something the protein used to do, and what you're calling your indirect effects is a protein doing something that we don't normally think it doing.
Yeah, so yeah, that could be loss of function and gain of function, that could be.
Yeah, I'm just nervous about it. I mean, function, for one, is really hard to define.
It depends.
So, for example, a lot of people define function as its evolutionary consequence and say that if it doesn't have an evolutionary consequence, it doesn't have a function.
If we take the titles out of that, sort of, this is what literature cites, fine. Titles are controversial, but not needed.
If you just used a little hyphen sub-bullet points, these are things that might happen. But let, and then you will see where he takes this.
Yeah, I mean, this is just to, yeah. So, I mean, I think because classically people have looked at these two effects in, say, separate, I mean, sometimes separate people, separate papers. This is, the principal component of studies that I could come up with. One could, but I did at some point have gain of function, loss of function. I mean, it's not clear cut. I agree. I mean, so I just show you some sample of papers that were published about the importance of being essential, the impact of essentiality on evolution. So So in other words, if you take yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, 20% of the genes are essential, meaning that if you knock them out, if you knock them down, the organism will die. And for now, many years, I think maybe one of the first idea of what should constrain the evolution of a protein, people have thought that essentiality or function should be the main constraint, because obviously if a protein is so important that the organism will die if it doesn't have that protein, any mutation that destabilizes to a large extent should be selected against, and therefore this protein should be conserved. Yet the first paper that asked this question, to my knowledge, was by Lawrence Hurst, and so they asked the question, do essential genes evolve slowly? And the answer was no. When you remove immunoglobulins, the rest of the proteome is actually, doesn't show this property. I think they did that actually in mice, using, knockout mice as a data set. So Hunter Fraser published a paper 2 years later, where they basically showed that protein dispensability, meaning if a protein is not dispensable, it should evolve more slowly. So they said that it was. Then they replied to this paper and they said that the rate of evolution. So they basically argued that this paper was wrong and that it was still not more conserved. So that was the answer to that paper, particularly because. There is a confounding factor in that study, which is gene expression level. So if gene expression is the main factor and essential proteins tend to be highly expressed, then maybe it's not the fact that they are essential that is important, but just the fact that they are highly expressed. And this debate has been going on for many years with a new paper coming here now. And this, for example, was several years later, and the answer was, again, no. So. If we had to vote, probably that essentiality is actually not very important. So this is just to give you an idea of one feature that has been investigated, and there are many more. Another is the impact of interactions on a protein's evolution. So let's say if you are a protein, and you have to bind to say 10 different partners, one might think that any mutation will have to satisfy the constraint of still being able to bind to these 10 partners. So there was this idea, also quite intuitive, that proteins that have a lot of interactions should evolve slowly. So there was a paper, again, by Hunter Fraser, saying that there was a simple dependence between evolutionary rate and number of interactions. Then Eugene Kooning came and said that there was no simple dependence between evolutionary rate and number of interactions, that only the proteins that have really high degree of interaction, so say 20, 50 interactions, were a bit more conserved. And then here we again get into the same trouble, that there is a dependence between the number of interactions and the cellular concentration. So Blumen and Demi said that this apparent dependence between high number of interactions and evolution was linked to biases in protein-protein interaction data, and one of the biases is the expression level. So actually, Hunter Fraser came back and said that still there was still an effect, which I would think that there is. I mean, there should be a small effect, and they replied again. So you can see that it's a field that is quite yes.
So how does this then compare back? If you look at proteins, you look at where they tend to have, if you look at them on a smaller level or more in a detailed atomic level, the positions that mutate or tend to change.
Yes, thanks, Dan. Yeah, it's a very important point.
Exposed places, whereas the places where a protein binds tend to be slow to evolve. So.
Yeah, so that's a very important point.
Yeah.
So here I voluntarily do not speak about conservation within proteins. I mean, there will be one slide about that. So within a protein, what Dan just said is that the surface tends to be less conserved than the core, and the reason for that is that a mutation in the core can affect the entire protein, whereas the mutation at the surface will have a more local effect, meaning that if you mutate the core, you could destabilize the entire protein. And this is more probably why, and this is a universal trend that has been studied by there is a very prolific literature on this as well, what best explains the variability of evolutionary rate within a protein. And so there is a lot of literature about that, but I voluntarily do not speak about it because that would be too much. So here we saw twice that there was a confounding factor here and in the previous slides. Which was gene expression, and indeed, expression level was found to be the main determinant, and this is actually quite clear. People agree on this. There have been many papers. They all agree on the fact that expression level is the main determinant of a protein's evolutionary rate. The only difference, I would say, lies in the way people measure expression. So you can measure expression by measuring the mRNA level, you can measure expression by the abundance of the protein itself. You can use also the codon usage because usually abundant proteins will tend to be optimized in terms of their codons. So there are many different measures that were used as a proxy for cellular abundance. But all of these measures all agree and always show that expression is the main determinant. Of evolution. And so, for example, in yeast, expression alone explains 40 to 50% of the variance in evolution. And evolution spans a huge dynamic range that can be, I'm not sure actually, but I would say maybe some proteins are probably 1,000 times more conserved than other proteins. So, and this has been shown in many different species, in fungi, bacteria, plants. Here it was many bacteria, and here it was several animals. So this appears as a universal law, that expression really is a main constraint acting on evolution. So this is actually quite puzzling, because again, if we come back to the example where a protein is essential, why would a protein that is essential not be more conserved than the protein that is not essential? I think this is a very profound question. If anybody has a suggestion, I could give you my take on this, but.
But I think you're just pushing it a bit far, because even if essentiality is not the main component, you can still have some bias. I don't think there is a unique answer, and just only a direct link between
So it means,
I guess the question is how many other alternative hypotheses have been tested in the literature?
So a lot of alternative hypotheses, but I think here the importance is on the magnitude, so let's say on the magnitude of the variance you can explain in evolution. So say being essential or not might explain 1% of the variance, which is very low. Gene expression alone would explain 40 to 50%. So it's really huge components it explains a lot. It has a very high predictive power, in other words, as to whether a protein will be conserved or not. Whereas essentiality has barely no predictive power compared to expression. It has a slight one. I mean, it probably has a slight effect, but it's virtually almost inexistent. Yes.
I think the problem here is the notion that what you call essentiality actually means anything. So we're talking about something that you're growing stuff in a rich medium, in a petri dish, or something, organisms that typically were adapted for generations to grow in petri dish.
So
let me just finish this. So one of the things we've noticed is that you take all the essential genes in yeast, and then look at their phylogenetic profiles. And actually, they are quite variable. They're polymorphic. There's many species that do not have the essential genes in.
Yeah, exactly. So that goes in the same direction. So being essential is not. I mean,
well, it's not that's a very important point. Is that that essential genes maybe that essential? No, I don't think it's.
It's exactly
what you said. It was meaningless. What you said. Are you trying to say that the assignment of essentiality is meaningless, or are you trying to say that the evolutionary variability of a protein is unrelated to its essentiality, which is...
Okay, I'm trying to say it is meaningless, and as such, any causality going on evolutionary rates, it's also meaningless. Because I think if you're just trying to define a phenotypic property associated with a very specific adaptation pathway,
I think I would push what you say
and which media?
So two things, two answers. The first one is that in this paper, what they actually took a data set of yeast exposed to hundreds of drugs, and so grown in hundreds of conditions, and measured, and so the fitness was measured in each one of these conditions, and they tried to find, to make any sense of these data. They couldn't. And in fact, they, what they call the always essential genes, so the ones that are essential across all conditions, were not more conserved. So, but yes.
If you look at the thermodynamic proteins, consider proteins as evolving thermodynamic objects, and just consider the problem theoretically, the strength of selection doesn't actually have much of an impact theoretically on how fast it evolves. So, I mean, I guess I'm just saying that that's a thing that sort of makes vague sense. But when you look at it and you say, okay, can I make a strength of selection on this? And that's because of the sort of mutation selection balance and you know where the protein will end up in terms of the fitness landscape. So it's not going to change where it is on the height of that fitness landscape in terms of the mutation selection balance that's achieved.
That's why this is actually very counterintuitive, because you would imagine there's not a higher fitness impact than dying. So if you have a gene and you mutate it and you die, you're not very fit. And yet that protein.
Right, and it's counterintuitive, but I'm just saying the math, how that works out, evolving thermodynamic objects is such that the strength of selection doesn't translate to protein conservation. I mean, just saying that as a direct consequence,
right.
But I mean, it's actually true that the theory doesn't work out, that there is a transfer.
I mean, if a mutation in one specific protein always have a strong deleterious effect in all the species in which this protein is present, then that protein will probably be highly conserved.
The effect of a mutation on fitness is not constant.
Exactly. Right. So to link now what you're saying and what they were saying, and this what I would say is the explanation is that essentiality within a species might be well defined, but it probably changes very rapidly across evolution. What is essential and what is not essential? That's exactly what you were saying in terms of the gene.
I think that's what they're saying, and it's not true. Right? I mean, there are certainly some. Isn't it maybe a stronger argument to say that essential genes, whatever that means and however we define them, are robust to their function, whatever makes them essential, is robust to mutational change. So you can tolerate a wider range of mutations in essential genes.
So that brings us, yes. I mean, I'm not sure that they are more robust than other proteins, but any protein is actually quite robust because a third of the mutations will not destabilize it.
Well, but isn't that what you're asking here? Why do some proteins evolve more rapidly than others?
And if
essential proteins are proteins that are more tolerant of mutational change.
I don't think. Why would they be more tolerant? I think any protein could be.
Perhaps that's part of their what makes them. I mean, if any change has a dramatically negative fitness effect, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
It's a protein that is more tolerant of mutation.
But then one could argue that to be more tolerant, it had to evolve in a space I mean, it has a restricted space to evolve, meaning because it can only tolerate mutations.
I would think so, but I also want to get back to this. I do want to make sure that we're clear on this. I'm not sure I understood what Zay was saying about essentiality or what. You could certainly explain this if indeed assignment of essentiality is meaningless because it means nothing
evolutionarily
versus another, or it means nothing evolutionarily. But I don't think that that's true. Certainly it may be true for many proteins, but as you were pointing out, it's not difficult to come up with quite a large set of proteins that are essential under essentially any conditions in any organism that we take a look at.
So surely, I mean, ribosomal proteins, they will generally be essential universally, but most proteins...
I wouldn't necessarily even say that that is true, right? And where there are paralogs that can substitute...
proteins, you can have buffer, but buffering...
But the argument is not worth having because essentiality does not directly translate into speed of evolution, even theoretically, once you do the math. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
Yep.
So it's just not worth having this argument of what it is, because even if it is something in Wisconsin, it doesn't translate.
I mean, it
should
translate, maybe not
think.
With the same magnitude as not with the same magnitude. I agree that it could not create the magnitude of difference in evolutionary rates that we observe, but it should translate it should translate into some difference, meaning that if a protein can accept 1 in 3 mutations, and a protein can accept only accept 1 in 10, just because of the functional constraint, then the one that can only accept 1 in 10 will probably evolve more slowly.
I'm saying directly that assumption is not the case. So essentiality does not translate into the scenario we just said.
Okay. So I'm missing something, but
you
can discuss
that. What are you thinking of?
So. You have a thermodynamic landscape, and you would basically get as stable as you need to be. Okay, and that means that being more stable isn't a benefit anymore, right? So when you're further down, when you're destabilized, it's a great benefit to be more stabilized. But when you're up here, it's not. So there's a direct change. I mean, there's a very strongly predictive change in the effect of substitutions as you move along the stability landscape. And plus what David said as well, that, you know, if you have a strong deleterious effect of a strong mutation, that means you're just going to move slightly up in the thermodynamic space, but it's a very, very high dimensional space. So you don't constrain percentage-wise, you don't constrain the possibilities very much by moving up very, very slightly. So it just doesn't translate to much of a measurable effect.
I don't see how your theory has anything to do with essential. Your theory is about stability of protein. But I don't see how that tells you one way or the other whether a more stable protein is essential.
It's about the size of the neutral space, if you want to put it that way. So I think that the evolvability of a protein is going to be directly correlated to the size of the neutral space, if you want to look about it that way. And I'm saying that essentiality doesn't translate into changing the size of the neutral space very much.
This one, maybe things with a different dimension. When we look at substitution models, and we've been deriving our own substitution models for specific classes of proteins, what was most striking to me is realizing that every single substitution is possible, and some of the counterintuitive ones are actually quite frequent.
Let me
just build the argument. So when we talk about, and that makes me think that talking about how many mutations you can accept is not necessarily the most informative question, but maybe where and what mutations you can accept. So maybe there's another dimension here that I don't know if you're going to explore north?
So, I mean, yeah, it's related to what Dan said, that, I mean, you don't accept mutations within a protein. Usually mutations, of course, would be of a specific type at the surface. Cyrus Schroti actually had a beautiful paper on that. But it's not, but I don't want to focus on individual proteins. I really want to see what is the difference between proteins. And I guess it's safe to assume that all proteins can accept mutations in the same way. So all proteins will prefer to accept mutations at the surface compared to the interior. But the question is really what are these rates, these absolute rates, different across proteins? So does that, is that clear? Okay. Anyway, so the evolution, I mean, gene expression, so protein abundance is the main determinant. The question is why. So the current paradigm, I think, that is probably most widely accepted would be is called the misfolding hypothesis, whereby the idea. So it was published. Originally, actually, there was an earlier paper, by Germans mostly. He had several papers on this, and the idea is that if you are a protein, and so you, let's say you just got destabilized by a mutation, and now 1 in 1,000 proteins are misfolded. So the idea is that if your cellular intracellular concentration is 1 nanomolar. Then you will create 1 picomolar of misfolded products. If now your concentration is 1 micromolar, the concentration of misfolded product will be, say, 1,000 times higher. So the idea here is simply that the concentration of toxic misfolded product will be proportional to the abundance of the protein itself. And that is that indeed can be a general mechanism that explains why why the constraint is proportional to the protein concentration.
I was just asking, this is ignorance on my part. So why would a misfolded protein be automatically toxic?
Of course, this is an important point. So in this paper, they showed that overexpressing a misfolded protein will be toxic to the cell. I mean, I think it's a very hard question in the sense that the effects that are driving evolution, the fitness effects that are driving evolution, are probably much lower than anything we can measure. So in that sense, I mean, Dan could comment much more on this than I could. I mean, that would be my guess. So, I mean, we know that if you overexpress a misfolded protein, it will generally be toxic. Now, if you are 1,000 times or even 100 times less expressed than the wild type concentration, how toxic is that? I don't know. It's probably less toxic, but I mean, probably maybe still toxic enough to be selected against. But this, I'm not aware of anyone that could measure like such small effects.
Well, I mean, you could argue that there isn't toxicity at all, right? That's just energetic toxicity. So if your proteins are unfolded, they're going to be subject to decay.
It could be the cost of degrading them. It could be also, yeah. I mean,
you're going to talk about another hypothesis.
But what? When I was talking to Christian, I mean, that was his point. What he said, I think, was very wise. It was that. That you cannot explain the toxicity by a subpopulation. You would need that the deleterious effect of this subpopulation to be amplified somehow through a gain of interaction. So let's say if this misfolded species goes interact with a crucial part of the machinery, then it could really create trouble. But on its own, I would personally not expect this to be on its own very deleterious. It would just go to an aggregation body being be degraded, and I mean, anyway. So this has been.
I wonder if there's some insight to be gained here from proteins that have been studied in great detail mutationally to ask about, say, the frequency of dominant negative mutations in protein interactions. So we certainly know some proteins for which it's very difficult to make dominant negative mutants in their ability to interact with other partners, and others where it's very easy.
Okay.
And so I mean, that's one way, probably the most common way of amplifying a toxic effect.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know of any large data set about this.
Yeah, I don't know of any. I mean, I only know of individual proteins that have been studied in great detail through screens. But certainly, I mean, this is one place where it would be nice to try to collect that information, because the literature is very biased on what reports are there. We've reported out, lots of people have reported on the ease of making dominant negative RAD proteins. We've tried to do similar experiments with all kinds of other proteins that haven't worked and which we've never reported on, despite the fact that we know we've been able to do saturation mutagenesis.
But then we naturally drift back to this functionality argument.
but in the context of an implicit functionality, when you say toxic, you're talking about a fitness effect. You're introducing functionality here.
You're
trying to make this, I mean, this needs to be a general effect, right? I mean, this can't just...
So that's why here the idea, I mean, behind this hypothesis is that the misfolded product is a toxic product, and that makes it very general. It means that every protein, every misfolded protein looks the same. It's just hydrophobic patches exposed and messing around. That's the beauty of this argument, is that it's very clear what is the generality of it. There is one thing that but it still does not explain fully the data, in the sense that, so this is a paper from Dan Tofik's lab where they showed that distribution of effects of impact on stability are universally distributed. So this is the change in stability. So zero means that there is no change in stability. The red and the blue curves, so this is actually experimental data from the Proton database. So the red curve is a distribution of impact on stability on buried amino acids, so that are buried inside the protein. So let's say that means that on average, if you introduce a random mutation, any amino acid to any other amino acid, you will have on average, you will destabilize the protein by 1 kilocal per mole, which is not a great destabilization. So that means that half of the proteins in the that are introduced in the protein interior will have either will destabilize the protein less than 1 kilocal per mole, or will have a stabilizing effect, which is very unexpected. If you take surface residues, then you are less destabilizing on average, but you are also less stabilizing on average, but so you have a great deal of mutations that virtually have no impact on stability. And that means that if you remember the two extreme examples I showed you at the beginning of the talk, with this very conserved protein and this very non-conserved protein, if stability and misfolding are really a constraint, it means that you can still accumulate a large number of mutations. I mean, you might evolve maybe a third slow, I mean, two times slower or three times slower, but it could not explain really the huge variability. It could not explain why your protein is fully conserved, because there are definitely mutations in the space nearby that would stabilize the protein. Yeah.
Do you have that for highly expressed and low expressed proteins?
So actually, there was the paper I cited from Chagnovich before showed one important thing, is that if you are highly expressed, you would be more optimized. If you can tolerate a certain absolute number of misfolded species. So if you have 1,000 copies, and one in 1,000 is misfolded, you will create one misfolded species, it's okay. So now if you are in 1,000,000 copies, and you have, your stability, your delta G, is such that one in 1,000 molecule will be misfolded, that might be not optimized enough. So you will be pushed towards a higher stability. So generally speaking, it's known that proteins that are highly expressed are more stable. And then that probably affects this in a way. So what the Chagnovich paper showed is that the delta delta G is actually dependent on delta G, not to a large extent, but there is a dependence that in fact is required to explain the stability conservation relationship. So there is a dependence. If that was your question,
I'm wondering, I believe that there's dependence on delta G, but is there an independent effect of concentration as opposed to?
So there is a weak correlation between delta G and delta delta G, and there is a weak correlation between concentration and delta G.
We
come back to like
this. Is there an independent effect of concentration on the distribution of delta delta G?
To my knowledge, there's no data on this, but there should be a weak effect. Whether it will be seen, I don't know.
Why would concentration affect delta G? I mean, this is just an intrinsic feature of the protein.
It is, but so the idea is that if you have a higher concentration, the cell will be less tolerant to any defect on that protein.
It's an issue of causality, right? I mean, the issue is not whether proteins with a higher delta G are more or less expressed. The question, or whether proteins with choose their delta G based on expression, but the other way around. I mean, if your argument is that higher, more highly expressed proteins are
naturally pushed,
less tolerant, or you won't express a protein highly if you are highly intolerant of misfolding. So that selection has favored increased expression only for proteins that are more tolerant of folding problems.
Yeah. I mean, another way to put it is simply if your fitness function depends on the concentration of.
I thought the issue was the concentration effect of folding.
I think he was asking whether the concentration is whether it's
really physical.
Right. No, I think the issue is whether it's correlated as a consequence of selection.
Although if there are oligomeric proteins, it means there's a concentration. Yeah. There can be a concentration.
Yeah. Also, I mean, but generally speaking, if there is any. If the fitness function depends on the fraction of unfolded species, on non-functional species, then the protein will be naturally pushed towards higher stabilities if it's
higher.
So to me, this plot alone suggests that, I mean, stability really should not be an issue, and misfolding, therefore, should not be an issue as well. Yes, this is just to show that all of these mutations here, generally speaking, should be beneficial. So
what is that experimental data set based on?
It's the ProTERM database that basically is a collection of all the experimental data required on mutation and stability measurements. Here in this paper, they studied many proteins using in silico and showed that the in silico measurements correlated very well with the experimental ones, actually.
So it argues against sampling bias in that data set, for example.
I mean, of course, I guess, I mean, there are probably more alanine mutations than tryptophan mutations, but I guess on average, I guess it's quite okay. So stability argument to me could not explain why this protein is so strongly conserved across species. So there could be another potential mechanism, which would be a hypothesis that I mentioned in my first talk, the misinteraction hypothesis. And the idea is that upon mutation can trigger misinteraction that could be deleterious to the cell. And so here, this is an experiment that we did where we expressed these homomers in cells, and we saw that they were homogeneously distributed. And then we introduced point mutations in one subunit that is naturally repeated by symmetry in all subunits at the top and at the bottom. And we often encountered, without any design, mutations that basically created long fibers that are in fact not that toxic. But again, I mean, it's hard to say because the level of toxicity that is selected and that we can measure are quite different. In many cases, though, they were toxic. So that's the idea that upon mutation could create sometimes misinteractions that themselves are deleterious. I think one feature of this explanation is that the mutation will fully contribute to the, I mean, the mutation, all of the population will now engage in the misinteraction. In the misfolding hypothesis, you have one mutation that creates a subpopulation that is toxic, whereas here, the entire population is kind of visible. So in that sense, maybe one can intuitively think that this could have a larger impact. And there were several papers suggesting that this constraint is important. Again, Chagnovich suggested that so that the constraint scales quadratically, which is intuitive again because when you add one protein, it can interact with all the others. A paper by George Zhang showing that suggesting that misinteraction does cause the highly expressed proteins to evolve slowly, and our own work where we showed that the surface of abundant proteins is tuned to avoid misinteractions. So these works together suggest that misinteraction could in fact be an explanation for why abundant proteins evolve slowly.
So
is
it true again why the misinteraction population is larger?
Sorry?
Why the misinteraction population
I removed it. Okay, so I had a slide that got lost. The number of complexes basically is proportional to the concentration of both proteins involved and the affinity constants. So if you increase the concentration of one of the partner, you will naturally increase the concentration of the complex. So in other words, if you are a highly abundant protein, you will be more prone to engage in non-specific interaction simply because your concentration is in the range of KDs that are neutrally explored or neutrally formed by random mutations. So in other words, so let's say if a random mutation can create by chance on quite frequently a KD of say in the high micromolar range, and your concentration is in the micromolar range, then you will create non-specific complexes. If your concentration is in the nanomolar range, you will not create almost any complex, any non-specific complex. So in that sense, the intracellular concentration would really be important in promoting the misinteractions.
But going back to your own talk,
yes,
from a week ago or whatever it was, it seems like those would be highly specific to the geometry of the protein, or whether it's
so,
a
but again, I mean,
at the surface of
so,
the protein.
Yeah, but here I would not consider the talk I gave, but rather this paper that shows that really, I mean, there is a strong correlation between the stickiness of the surface of a protein and its abundance. So it's really the whole protein surface that is tuned to avoid misinteraction. One could then argue that this constraint this composition constraint could act as a global constraint for the evolution of the sequence. We will see
that surface stickiness that you talked about is part of the basis of the protein misinteraction avoidance.
Yes.
So is that true that surface stickiness is inversely correlated with
protein abundance? It's pretty.
Is it also true that that high abundant proteins are less prone to misinteraction in mutational studies, even
this
if you
is a,
correct for
this is a known. I mean, this is unknown. I mean, it's really hard to. Although we did publish a paper where we show that the number of misinteract. I mean, but this is simple thermodynamics, and if you are highly expressed, you will.
Right. I mean, the problem is you have to control for expression. You have to control for expression for the reasons that you just cited. Higher abundance is going to mean that a smaller change in KD is going to lead to misinteraction.
Yeah. So, but we will see that in fact this is actually probably not true either. Okay. So now we go to the second part of the talk where I'll show you some results. Okay. I have to hurry up. There are not many slides, so I guess it should be okay. To investigate basically the misfolding and the misinteraction hypothesis, we used a specific class of proteins that are the intrinsically disordered proteins. And these offer a great advantage, which is first that if you are intrinsically disordered, I mean, that means you are intrinsically unstructured, and you have evolution has shaped those proteins to be unfolded, to exist most of the time in an unfolded state. And therefore, mutations that cause misfolding should not really be a problem because they are already misfolded, I mean, unfolded. So that's...
I don't know what is the frequency, but many of these would be on this induced folding by interactions.
No, I mean, there are many that do that, but many don't as well. What I will show you we use all the disordered regions. Some proteins indeed have this induced fit or induced folding mechanism. But again, I mean, if you isolate that protein and you measure its delta G, it will be mostly unfolded. I mean, its natural state is to exist in an unfolded state. So one could argue that maybe it now acquires a mutation, it's not going to be able to bind to the partner it should have been bound to, but it will still remain in a state that where it already was, meaning that if it should not be much more deleterious because of misfolding. That's what I mean.
And maybe you accumulate more of that protein than you should accumulate because it's not bound to the partner, so it can still be.
I agree. I mean, if the function of disorder was only induced fits, the argument would be a bit weak. But I think most of the a lot of the disordered regions are used in various functions, say binding through motifs. And in that sense, I think it's okay. And actually, it's a control. Sorry, it's a control we haven't done, but we could probably do it. And I'm pretty sure we will see the same. Result that I'm going to get to, hopefully. So this is just a paper by Keith Dunker showing that, so this is disorder content, and this is genome size. Not that there is any, not that one should expect any correlation, but most, all I wanted to show is that in unicellular and multicellular eukaryotes, we see that you have a cloud here, which corresponds to 35 to 45 to 50% disordered, meaning that 35% to 50% of all amino acids in eukaryotes, on average, are in disordered regions. It's a huge fraction. Yes?
Since this has come from Dunker, is this predicted disorder?
It's predicted disorder, yeah. But I mean, I think it has proven, you can take any predictor, and it's usually the same, you will get the same numbers. You might predict 10 or 20% that are not disordered, and you predict them as disorder, and you might not predict 10 or 20% that you predict them as, you predict it as order and it is in fact disorder. So it might not be 100% accurate, but I think the number on average is quite reliable, meaning that this fraction here, I would trust it really strongly. So
there's been some efforts to try to analyze the accuracy of that from some of the bacterial structural genomics projects, and I think that their correlation has actually been very high.
Oh yeah, you know, it's actually, it took time to penetrate the protein community, this, and especially the structural biology community, but I think now it's quite, I hope it's well established concept. So this is just an example of a very famous protein. This is p53, and this is the predictor. So the prediction from Keith Dunker's software Ponder. So here, one means that it's predicted as being disordered, and zero means that it's predicted as being ordered. So here, you see here that you have mainly so one domain here that is mostly predicted as being disordered with one dip, and that's actually a binding site. So here, that's what Zay was referring to. So here you have, in the natural state, you won't have a helix. It forms a helix when it binds, but you can see that, I mean, it's not really like a fold. It's really a small portion that forms a helix. So here you have all these regions have been actually crystallized, and I believe, and so you can see that this large portion of disorder, it's thought that its main function is basically to act as a scaffold and bind to different proteins. Then you have the ordered domain here in blue, and then you have a tetramerization domain here, and again some disordered region that binds to different proteins.
These arrows you're showing here are fragment structures?
Yes, exactly. So here, this fragment here has been is shown here, this one, et cetera. So this is just to illustrate the fact that, I mean, even a protein that pretty much everybody knows, p53, is subject to using disorder in its function. So in our work, what we did is to take all the proteins from yeast and human, and we basically then predicted the domains using PFAM and the disordered regions using disopred, disembl, and iupred. And then we were very strict in saying what is disordered. So to say that a region was disordered, it had to be predicted by, I mean, here what I will show you is for iupred, and not be present in a domain. So it's a combination of disorder prediction and domain prediction. So these would not be predicted as being disordered, even though they might be grafted loops. And we said that the ordered regions were basically the predicted PFAM domains after removing any disordered region. So we were strict in this definition. And then we measured the evolutionary rate of all the proteins in both yeast and human. So the way we did it, so because usually when people calculate DNDS, you take a whole protein and you calculate the number of substitutions that you see in the full protein. I mean, you get one number per protein. Here we wanted to have a number per region or even a number per amino acid. And for this, but importantly, we wanted to be able to compare, say, this region in that protein to that region in this other protein in terms of evolution. So Benjamin did multiple alignments for every protein, then concatenated all the proteins into a giant multiple alignment, and then ran this software rate for sight on the full concatenated alignment, such that now the rates that were obtained can be compared within the full alignment. So we got amino acid specific rates, and from this we derived per protein a median rate per region, either for the ordered part or the disordered part, by simply taking the median of all the amino acids.
What are the taxa that you're considering here for your alignments?
Sorry?
What?
Yeah, so Benjamin sent it this morning. I didn't have time to include it, but basically for the human, it goes to elephant, ferret, cat. So we have 10 species. So it's quite close species. And for yeast,
all vertebrate within yeast. Right?
Yeah, a few vertebrates within mammals. And in yeast, we go down. We have about 13 or 14 species. I have it here actually.
That's all right. We can look at it later.
But it's a wider, it's a longer period of time for yeast than for mammals, as far as I know. So then we extracted protein abundance data from a great database that is called PaxDB for both yeast and human, and this is just to convince ourselves that the predictions are correct and that what we see is expected. And so here, for each point is a protein. So this is for yeast, this is for human. Each point is a protein. The x-axis is the evolution of the ordered region within that protein, and the y-axis is the evolution of the disordered region. So what we see here is that within proteins, the disorder is always less conserved than the order, which makes sense because it's the same as surface interior. Usually a mutation in the disordered part will be tolerated simply because it's local, it doesn't disturb the rest of the protein. So there are a few outliers where the disorder is more conserved than the order, which is interesting, but for the vast majority of proteins, the disorder is always less conserved. So this is what we expect. The question now is, how does the conservation of disorder, how is it influenced by abundance? So here we have yeast and here we have human. So this is what has been seen before. So we have the abundance. So each point now is a protein. So this is a full-length protein. each point is a protein. The x-axis is the abundance. The y-axis is the rate of evolution. So the higher, the less conserved. So we can see that as proteins have a higher abundance, they get more and more conserved. And this is true both in yeast and in human. Now, when we look at ordered region, we see the same that it was expected. But actually, the correlation is a bit lower. When we focus exclusively on disordered regions, we see that we actually get similar correlation. So clearly, the disorder is subject to is constrained by abundance as much, if not more, as ordered regions, suggesting that misfolding is not an issue. So if misfolding is not an issue, what could constrain its proteome? The second hypothesis was misinteraction, so we sought to investigate that.
I was wondering, because we're using this rather strict definition of order disorder, I guess you have also the rest.
Okay.
How much is the rest?
Good question. So, I mean, here the rest is actually a lot in the sense that here we only use proteins to be really able to compare it. We only use proteins that have both order and disorder. So here's the rest. So here you have 1,500 proteins in yeast. So that's a quarter of, or a good quarter to a third of all proteins. So the rest would be much more in terms of proteins that have either only disorder or only order. In terms of coverage, within a protein, I couldn't tell you actually.
Because, for instance, if you take, when you were saying using PFAM to define domain, but it's actually known that there are many regions with domains that are missed by PFAM. So those are.
But so if a domain is missed by PFAM and not predicted as being disordered, then that will be the rest, basically. Or if it's conflicting, it will also be the rest.
Yeah, so the point is whether it's 80% of the sequence.
It's definitely not 80%. I would, if I had to take a guess, I would say maybe 20%, but I would expect around that. I mean, but yeah, I could ask Benjamin and tell you tomorrow. So if misfolding is not the constraint, then perhaps that misinteraction is. So this is a slide I showed before. I will go quickly over it, but basically, all you need to know is that we derived a stickiness scale for amino acids, so here this is the stickiness value. So here lysine is deemed non-sticky because it's found often at the surface and very rarely at protein-protein interaction sites. So now that we have this stickiness scale, what we can do is take the disordered regions, and instead of calculating the evolution by averaging evolutionary rate, we now average the stickiness in the disordered region and see whether that correlates with abundance. So here that's for the full-length protein. So here what we do is we take the full-length protein and average all the stickiness of all amino acids in that protein and plot it. So that's the y-axis. And in the x-axis, you have the abundance. So you see that there is actually, even when you take the full-length protein, a weak correlation between abundance and stickiness. So proteins are globally less sticky when they are abundant. When we look at the ordered region, we see similar numbers. And when we look at disordered region, we see a small increase for yeast and something comparable to for human. So meaning that here, these disordered regions are more sticky than these disordered regions, suggesting that there has been some pressure to bias their composition to make them non-sticky. One thing that I should highlight is that here, the disorder is largely predicted based on composition already. So I would believe that if we had information of the on disorder independently of the prediction, these would actually be improved because, I mean, the prediction naturally makes them more homogeneous than they should be. Meaning that if you have a very sticky disordered region, it will probably not be predicted as being disordered. So I would say that these correlations are probably underestimates. What I want to show, generally speaking, is that there is here a correlation suggesting that stickiness is constrained as a function of abundance. So the next thing that we did is to look at the same this correlation and the previous one that I showed you. but now by tissue. And the idea is that different tissues will, I mean, in human, of course, will exhibit different abundances. And the question is, which tissue has the abundance that best matches the, either the evolution or the stickiness?
Does disorder not reduce stickiness by itself? That regardless of composition, if disordered, it's going to tend to not stick very well?
I'm not sure.
I'm just trying to think about this, but wouldn't disorder tend to reduce stickiness?
No. I mean, if you take a disordered protein and you put a few hydrophobic residues, it will aggregate, that's for sure.
Just one question about your stickiness index. You derived it looking at the surface of interacting proteins.
Sorry?
You derived it, so based on structure.
Yeah.
Do you have any reason to believe that it's going to be like the same in unstructured regions?
I mean, I would say yes, because this stickiness scale gives you is the propensity for a residue to interact with other residues. So I would say that I would expect this to be independent of the context. It's just that, say, if you are an arginine, you can interact with many different types of amino acids in many different orientations. If you are a lysine, there is very you're just not a good interactor. So in that sense, I would expect things to be quite consistent. Maybe that there could be small changes. I mean, say polyglutamines, for example. So if you have a large polyglutamine tract, it's not the same form of stickiness, but you will also aggregate. It could also be a function. Could be a function.
Abundance, right? I mean, so you say your polyglutamines can form. Can be highly sticky, but only if there's sufficient number of glutamines.
That's a very specific case, and I would expect such specificities to exist in disordered regions. But I think I would expect on average that things remain valid. The simple fact that we do see a correlation to me validates this idea.
So in the interest of time,
yes. Okay, so I think I have two more slides. So here we basically looked to the correlation I showed you between disorder and abundance. Here it's the same. Here we just plot a bar plot of correlation values, taking abundance that were of proteins measured in different tissues. So this is the correlation between the evolution and the abundance. So we can see that proteins in the brain, the abundance of proteins in the brain best explains or best correlates or has the strongest association with evolution in general, because evolution is an organism-based value, whereas here abundance is a tissue-specific based value, but the one tissue that best correlates with the evolution is brain. And then we have reproductive tissues. And at the bottom, we have fluids, which I think is interesting in this, with respect to misinteraction, actually. So when we looked at the stickiness abundance correlations, we actually found something that is quite similar with fluids at the bottom. So what we decided to do is to plot these values versus these values. And we saw something that actually seems to exhibit some correlation with fluids being non-correlated in both cases, and brain and reproductive tissues being correlated. So taking this at face value, it's tempting to speculate that, I mean, evolution and stickiness are somewhat correlated in the way they are constrained in different tissues. But when we looked at the correlation between stickiness and evolution, there was just no correlation when we control for abundance. It's basically a cloud. So this is the status of Benjamin's research, and we are not sure what to think about this. I was looking forward to get your input and perhaps ideas. I have a theory of actually why, but I'm not sure you want to hear it now. We could discuss it maybe later in the interest of time. So yeah, so I'll just stop here and thank you for your attention. And actually, I forgot at the beginning of the call, but I wanted to thank you, Shelley, and Mike for this superb conference. And that was, I'm leaving this week and I really had a great time.
Thanks.
So it means that we did a regression between abundance and evolution. And then we use the residuals of the abundance. So that's.
Right, exactly. So you got the laws and then you have done.
Sorry?
Or selection stuff.
You want to say something to
Yes, yes. No, yeah, but what, so what you can do is you can so you I mean, here, let's say that you have. Yes, so you correlate abundance to evolution, and yeah, then you only take the residuals of evolution around.
It's really easy to make dominant negative. And the amount of computations, they fall all over evolution. They're not all
for high abundance, you are slowly.
It's really easy. It's really easy to make.
And so now you take the residuals of the evolution and you plot. So what is shown here is the residuals of evolution versus thickness. It's not, if you do plot the absolute numbers for evolution, you will see a weak correlation. But I think then it's just because of abundance. Thickness versus abundance. So this we saw is basically this. Generally much more this is order, this is disorder.
Okay.
Because then you need the structure.
Try to engineer.
And we don't have many structures, so we wanted to have a pretty wide description. Because this is easy to predict without structure.
We engineer all 20 mutations into that site.
Since I did it before, and I saw also a correlation. When I did it for surface and interior, surface is the thickness of surface is correlated with the thickness of interior as well. Makes sense because it's hidden inside, so it doesn't.
The thickness of surface.
Not true.
Not the protein I've looked
at. Abundance.
The proteins I've looked at.
Yes, but then it's not correlated to evolution.
They don't bind as well. They're partially defective.
Yeah.
My take on it is that stickiness, the function of stickiness is a compositional constraint, so meaning that you have to be non-sticky. Does that really, is that really a burden in terms of divergence? Probably not, because say, every person has a compositional constraint, so the interior protein is more hydrophobic. But some proteins have a hydrophobic interior are now very conserved, and some proteins have a hydrophobic interior are now absolutely not conserved. So what I mean is the composition. Yeah, exactly. So this is a compositional constraint. So there is a proteome-wide compositional constraint, that's for sure. Does that mean that stickiness is one of the main determinants driving the evolution of proteins? No, I don't think so. So I don't think that this interaction is actually. I don't think that it's. I think that it is. I think that it is a proteome-wide constraint, and it is there, and proteins are fated to avoid it. But it doesn't limit protein to accumulate mutations. Yeah. So why do my conclusion is that we don't know. That's my conclusion.
We should see a different profile, high temperature versus low temperature.
My conclusion is that we don't know. We still don't know. To me, it's yet an open question. I have a theory though, and if you want, I can show it to you.
But yeah. For some temperature sources, right? You will see. There's always a huge collection that temperature sources are CI and hobby beams.
That it was and misfolding.
I don't follow this.
What do you mean?
You said that it was 1% of the misfolding. So part of your argument was that one in a thousand misfolding.
Because I certainly know that some of those temperatures are
sticky packs that affect all of them, and that will have to be. That was basically your argument.
At the beginning, yeah, but then I disproved that. Then I don't think it's actually a big effect. I mean, I think it's a big effect in the sense that it will constrain the composition. That I mean, it is, to me, it is a constraint on the cell that is permanently there, and the cell has to live with it, and it can, and I mean, it is an effect that is highly present, but I don't think that it limits the evolution to a large extent. I don't think that.
So that means if they have they're able to fold and they're able to react.
Sorry, I mean, it's one of the only thing that it's Which doesn't what?
So stickiness doesn't mean evolutionary rate of protein.
You're just trying to figure out.
Misfolding.
Yeah. So misfolding also to me doesn't, because if misfolding was the main explanation for why highly abundant evolved slowly, then the disorder here should not undergo, should not be constrained. Yeah, kind of, yeah. But this would not, the thermodynamics is not convince many people. The idea of at the base of this one is that it stabilizes the protein and create a new species. But here, in those regions, when you accumulate mutation, you don't create a new species, you just remain in the same state most of the time.
With
the disorder.
Yeah, so that, how does this
personal view on this, which Shelley has heard before,
how does the disorder say anything about misfolding? I don't think it does.
Because, I mean, the argument is that misfolding. The argument is that if misfolding was the only, was the main driving force for why
Evolution
proteins are more conserved, then we should see that effect more strongly in proteins that we know should fold compared to regions that don't need necessarily to fold.
So if I
had seen a strong correlation here and a weak correlation there, I would have said, yeah, misfolding, I mean, it's compatible with this observation.
Let me get this.
So
if I'm part of the problem too.
So if we had seen a strong correlation between abundance and evolution in ordered regions that meet where folding is important, and a weak correlation in these other regions where folding is not important, then I would have said, yes, this folding is the explanation.
You're making a logical.
Why?
Because when we're talking about misfolding, we're not trying to. Disorder and misfolding are two separate.
The argument is that disordered regions should not be subject to the misfolding problem.
I know.
You're arguing, which is a lot, which is
a lot of
okay.
And like,
The mutations.
It's like the sales job.
That was unfortunate.
It was like.
We could have talked about.
Sounds like waste.
If
they're on state assumption. Okay.
I'm actually getting friendly shit about that.
It should be true, because if you are a protein that does not need to fold, then you cannot mutate.
As I said, it sounds like just a sales job.
Simple like that.
It came over very negative, like, oh, you know.
So we're talking about property of the entire road. This is the property of part of the, these are properties of parts of the road, right?
I mean.
Now we're talking about property of the entire road.
Yeah, but so let's say you have a protein that has a dotted tail. You can mutate anything in that tail, it's not going to change the stability of the protein.
If we all refuse to indulge in it, I think the problem is so severe.
On the tail, possibly more so. So, yeah.
The other aspect, the possibilities that are tied up to this.
You're making that, this is an assumption, okay, and you're making an argument, and this is internal. Okay, so a lot of that disorder can be loose and even the backside of the protein.
So again, we did not consider any disordered region that is within a domain, within the folded domain.
So the thing that I'm trying to acknowledge that misfolding is partly a property of, so largely a property of,
but I'm not sure.
Misinteraction between different parts of the protein.
I think there's also a.
Okay, and so there's actually, it's actually the full. So, let's just.
For the protein, we're going to be presenting only one fold, and it's fold two.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is a completely different fold. So this tail might be here in this fold region.
I agree.
Right?
I agree.
And I mean, that multiplies by 10 to the whatever. I mean, this is that there isn't just one misfold. There's.
I agree that.
I'm not even trying to argue that that's kind of right. I mean, I see why you're thinking it, but I just think it's important to really think through, is that true?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the context of these things.
That was my first.
Part of the problem is these are evolved.
I entirely agree. I mean, and I think we need to make one or two additional controls to really make the point stronger. However, I think that you would agree that generally this contributes very little to, on average, I'm talking about average. This would contribute much less to stability than any amino acid that is within the domain.
Do you think that on average this could contribute as much as this?
I want to be clear about my level of disagreement. I think that's something you need to prove.
Okay.
Right? And I guess I would argue on that.
I
don't like to make those sorts of assumptions.
I think the kind of proof is actually here, in the sense that why are these other regions evolving much faster on average? Within any protein, the other region is much more free to evolve compared to the other region.
How many times?
So that is simply because. It doesn't contribute to the structural stability of the protein. It's just each position is kind of independent. So if you have a motif, then you will have the functional constraint. But as a.
So the problem
is your scientific significance than the papers we published.
I'm actually really not convinced. So
not saying
then because. Let's just say 99%.
What is the rank? The rank of?
These are different
contributions.
These are different sequences, rank, order, by probability.
These are sequencing. Sequences. Sequence space of one protein or for this protein?
This is the rank.
And I was really impressed. This is all sequences. I was really impressed.
Okay.
Rank order based on the probability of
folding. Okay.
okay? So you will evolve to the point where you're.
Life turned around.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, if you're just so like.
Wanna help her, she got married.
Reflecting on probability. So the thing is.
She got a grant, and she started publishing. And exactly.
Your arguments here about disorderly.
Yes.
Are really on probability of folding, which I agree with.
That I hope to.
In general. Okay.
Yeah, but the problem with this is that.
But it's your tail, it's the question, is.
At whose work.
Are you selecting.
And who I was sure.
On, probability of. You know, one minus.
I was shocked, to be honest.
Times concentration, whatever it is for concentration.
It was really.
What symbol is it for concentration?
C is good, right?
No, actually not.
Okay, so, and if this is, and on this, you do it linearly.
It's, so.
So if you assume.
I'm gonna run.
Just linear relationship.
So what is here, and I'm not sure if this is again rental.
This is again.
I need one for a couple days.
So I'm. So.
So I'm arguing the real question.
Does anyone?
That you're dismissing. Okay, so I would argue this is a pretty, so I think that there's a pretty good argument that.
I could use that.
Sure, and the concentration doesn't affect it, so concentration affects it.
I'll give it to you.
If this is.
Yeah, there's obvious.
A little sticky.
And this is the level of deleterious effect.
I didn't stick it on the windshield.
Right, it's proportional.
So you could, it's a, if they check.
So what, wait, I mean, okay, so here you have the fraction of misfolded protein times concentration.
I don't think they should.
And I'd be willing to risk the ticket.
I'm not sure what you see.
So this is the concentration.
Okay.
Times the probability of misfolding.
Okay, so the amount of misfolding protein.
If you're going up here, I'm going to put another argument.
But I mean, here I
just interrupt for 1 second. So,
yes.
So that was really nice, Sandy. I'd like to talk to you about it.
Okay.
Further.
Okay.
I have to talk with Shelley about some stuff. So maybe okay. We can talk later today.
To the barbecue today. Yeah.
Because I have some specific suggestions and some things I'd like to come out of. The biggest thing that I've push for is for insight into these proteins that comes from evolution of the proteins over time. So for example, if you compare orthologs between yeast and human,
yes.
Right, so I mean, you'd love to pull out the subset of proteins for which these things change.
Yes.
Right, so there will be some of these proteins where we can unequivocally assign orthology based on sequence with no question about differences in changing function.
Yeah.
Where you'd like to ask, where do these rules apply in one and not another? So my biggest push on this is, these things don't mutate. I mean, look, they're the same between humans and elephants. I say, give me a break. Humans and yeast are more or less the same from a eukaryotic perspective.
So
we can talk about, I don't want to interrupt your discussion with David, but let's talk about it.
Okay. But I just don't see what do you mean by this linear line, because, I mean, so the
well, okay,
I would say that
so
the fraction, you would have something.
How about this?
I mean.
Let's make this. Let's just say it's 1/f.
So what is one?
The fitness. I'm not even sure the exact function is.
I mean, the thing is, generally speaking, I would expect again. I mean, if you have a protein that folds. It's an assumption that I didn't make clear enough, but generally speaking, domains are independently folding units. Generally, again, I mean, I'm not talking about any specific domain, but generally speaking, the domain will fold whether you add like, for example, you know, like you can take proteins. We do that all the time. You take a GFP and you fuse it to a protein, and most of the time it's not going to affect its folding.
This is true.
So in that sense, if you accept that domains are independently folding units, and you look at regions that are between domains, or at the beginning or at the end of the protein, I would expect, on average, again, on average, and there might be one, I agree with you that there might be cases where this part kind of competes within the protein with a helix, and that can exist, of course. Mm-hmm. But on average, I would expect that these regions contribute little stability compared to the amino acids within the domain itself.
I agree that I kind of would, yeah.
So
and
if one
certainly on the tails too. I mean, I think.
So if one accepts this, then all I wanted to show was that that the correlation then should be stronger for domains compared to non-domains. But it's the opposite that we see. So it's not black and white. I agree. I show it. I present it as
which
black and white.
Which correlation is strong?
I present it as black and white, and it's not black and white, but that was for, I like to be very schematic. Sometimes it's bad. So here, the correlation for order, so the correlation for domains, the evolution of domains does not correlate as well with abundance as the evolution of disordered regions does. So,
0.7 versus 0.46.
But it's so many points that I think it's quite a reliable number.
I'm willing to agree that the difference is reliable, but the effect is not very different.
But the idea is that if misfolding was the main force driving this decrease,
what's the unlabeled axis again?
The what?
The unlabeled axis.
Ah, that, all right. That's evolutionary rates. So here we have the rate. So this protein is not abundant and it evolves fast. This protein is very abundant and it's very conserved.
Yeah.
So this decrease is not as sharp for regions where folding is always an issue. I mean, is clearly an issue. Is less sharp for those parts of, compared to disordered regions where folding may sometimes be an issue, but I think in many times is not an issue at all. So I mean, I would have expected that people here would have expected something very weak before seeing the figure. Like if someone who has been working on the misfolding hypothesis, I would expect that this person would. And in fact, in the Zhang paper on the,
they have further to fall though too.
They have a strong. They start higher, so they can fall lower.
Let's just put it this way. I mean, I very much appreciate why you're making the argument, right? But I still.
What would convince you as?
Okay. So the problem, still think here is again this.
Yes.
Right. So it's the probability. Let's look at it history. Forget about this.
Yes.
Okay. So let's just. So what I'm saying is, I'm assuming that what you're right is that what you're almost certainly absolutely right in is that the substitution here, right, doesn't affect the delta G.
Yes.
It doesn't affect the
neighboring domain.
The enthalpy.
Yes.
It doesn't affect the stability for this structure.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily say anything about how it affects the stabilities of the alternate structures that it's competing with.
So I'll share with you an additional control that Benjamin has not done yet, but that we will do, and you can tell me if it would be convincing.
Okay.
There are many proteins. So as we saw with p53, for example.
Also, can I just have one little?
Sure, of course.
I mean, is it, we're talking about what I do think is that most proteins,
we're talking about if it's pressured to fold, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this is a very, very, very small tail. Right. So the thing is that this part of it is still, you know, 0.1%, right? But the deleterious effect is being amplified by the concentration.
Yeah, remember? Yeah.
Right. So, but in terms of the folding reaction, this is still a very, very small effect. Right. So it's a small effect on the. It's yeah, still a small effect on the probability of folding, a very, very small effect on the probability of folding, but a bigger effect on the tail. That's all I wanted to
okay, I mean,
say. Is that,
but I guess the argument, generally speaking, is that there are exceptions where a disordered region could contribute to folding either on its own with a partner, with an alternative structure of the same protein. These scenarios are completely, I mean, can be envisioned. But on average, I would expect disordered regions to contribute to not be as subject to the necessity to fold as ordered regions are.
But I'm saying my argument.
And so, for example,
we agree on that.
But
the necessity to fold, but that doesn't mean that they're not contributing to the misfold. Right, and they might even be more strongly contributing to the misfold. I don't know. I mean, that's not a very big difference. So, you see what I mean? It doesn't. This is my argument: is that it doesn't say that they're not contributing to the misfold. And this.
I mean, the thing. It's like saying, let's try to misfold a protein by fusing stretches of amino acids. And in some cases, it could surely have an impact.
Fusing?
Yeah, so if you take a protein and you fuse.
Let's not change the flow.
No, but
by changing the rate. Let's just, because we're just talking about the.
No, but that's the thing. So, I mean, if you fuse. If you have a domain and you fuse a segment of amino acids, how likely is it that this segment will affect the folding of the protein?
Wait, what did you sorry? You're
because I mean, one? Here the argument that you made is that this disordered region could potentially through a mutation. Induce the misfolding of that protein or promote the misfolding of that domain. So my question is, how likely is it in general that if you have a folded domain and you even not make just one point mutation but add a completely new segment, how likely is it that this is going to affect the folding of the protein?
I would argue that it's completely irrelevant.
Why?
Because the only argument I would make is that we're talking about evolved things. So if you, I'm not making an argument about random samples of either the protein or the misfolded region.
Okay, so
I'm arguing I would always be asking a question about what's the state.
So you're asking about the function. You're asking about the function of that disordered region and whether the function of that region is to induce an alternate folding. Species?
Let me put it this way. If you imagine this disordered region, right? Okay. It evolves quickly because it's not contributing to the folding very
yes,
much.
Yes.
Okay. But as it evolves quickly, it still has to avoid these guys. And don't forget, this is like multiplied by 10 to the, you know, 200s or something. Very, very large number. Okay, so
what do you mean?
The alternative sequence, the alternative structures that need to be avoided is presumably extremely large. I mean, I made up the number, but it's probably big. We can call it 10 to the 60th if you want, something large.
Okay.
Okay, so the alternative structures, there are very, very many alternative structures. So you would agree that although this is not contributing to the stability of this, I mean, to the energy of this, right? It must evolve to avoid any contributions to the stability of these alternative structures.
But again, I mean, that's why I was, because here your the argument is that the by chance, well, you, I mean, because...
Do you agree with that? No.
I'm not really, and the reason is that here, the argument, if I understand it correctly, is that the space of possibilities to interact with the structure is so vast that you really have to work hard to avoid any to avoid any of these combinations that could.
Well, you have to consider that. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's why I use this example, because it illustrates that by chance, I mean, it's very unlikely that a mutation will actually interfere with the domain. I'm sure that there are cases where it does, but again, I mean, I'm always thinking on average, I would expect that these don't interfere. So one possible control, could be, what I mean is, okay, let's say that you take, okay, so I'll let you finish, sorry.
Well, I'm just saying this is the ground state, right? And I guess we want maybe this is you know, this is 10 to the, you know, I don't know, 10 to the 100, right?
Yeah.
Very large number of alternative energies, right? So all I'm, you have this gap, right? So I mean, you could say that the ones here are most important, right? But in evolution, the other ones at different levels also contribute specifically to the delta G.
But so that's the thing. So I mean, if you take a protein, so if you go back to this figure, here. So
yeah, this is where you just dismiss it on, like, how did you do that?
What do you mean?
Well, this is where you dismissed stability.
Yeah.
And I wasn't buying that.
So the idea is simply that. You have one quarter of mutations are stabilizing and not destabilizing.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that if stability is really the factor that needs to be selected for, so you will only accept 1 in 4 mutations, because only 1 in 4 that is sampled will actually fall on the stabilizing. If it's actually perhaps more, because you can, once you have this one, you can go here. But so if you have a conservative estimate.
Can you get me from office?
Okay, Melika. See. Lock it, I guess, hopefully. So do you agree with that? So you could still accumulate 1 in 4 mutations, because 1 in 4 mutations are indeed in fact stabilizing. So it's not a...
So your argument against stability...
Wait. No. Now I'm forgetting about these other regions for now. I'm just...
Yeah.
Because I'm just going back to this argument. So 1 in 4 mutations would be stabilizing. So if stability was an issue, then we should see rates that differ by, say, a factor of 4, but not much more, because you can still accumulate many mutations that, if stability is the main factor, you could still accumulate many mutations, particularly at the surface, because at the surface it's a larger area, or actually it seems. So what I mean is...
So that's an argument. So far, what you just said is an argument against stability, yes.
Yes.
Which we both agree on.
Ah, okay, so.
Stability in itself directly, so that's the P, that's this.
But stability, stability and misfolding are very much related. In other words, to create misfolded species, you need to change the stability. You need to impact the stability.
You do, but this is why I was drawing this, is that the relationships are different.
So this I didn't get, but I mean.
So the thing is, the point is, if you're doing, so what I'm saying, stability, and I think you'll agree roughly, is selection on probability of folding.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing is that basically you can only select so far, yay far, right? And there's still a lot of sequence space here.
So most proteins they move in that region. I mean, they don't go here.
So the point is then selecting for stability. Even if you marginally increase and say I want it to be slightly more stable, okay, you don't have much effect on constraint on sequence space.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. But that's not true for instability. If instability is dependent on protein concentration.
But that's just a multiplicative factor.
So of the tail.
So that I don't. So here I don't get because. I'm not getting this argument.
So. I'm going to actually change the axis on this. So this is going to be fitness. And that means that fitness is low when this... No, that is right. Okay, yeah, fitness is low when this is high, right?
Fitness is high when this is low, yeah.
So it's this way.
Yeah. Fitness is high when this is low, yes.
Did I do that right? No.
Yeah, when you have a high fitness, you have little misfolded species.
Okay. Yeah. And when you have a low fitness, yeah. Okay. Right. Good.
Okay. But we are depending on this. So if the probability of folding.
Let's just break down to say, look, you have a given selection on the probability of folding.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that this then is roughly constant, right? So you agree that this.
Yeah, so wait. So why is this constant? Why is 1 minus PF constant?
Because if you have a constant. If you have a constant selection for the probability of folding.
So, I mean, the thing is each mutation, will either push you to the right or to the left, which basically, and how many mutations will push you to the right or to the left is given by these plots, if it works. Okay,
right. But they're not pushing you up and down very much. The magnitude of pushing you up and down is they're pushing you right and left.
Well, of course they can push you a lot. I mean, they can push you again. So it's all it basically.
Okay, look.
That's basically
this. We think that there is selection on the probability of four. Would you give that?
There must be.
This is the reason,
within proteins, yes. Within protein, this is why the interior evolved more slowly than the surface, and this is why the disordered regions evolve.
So based on selection on the probability of folding, we expect to be here, right? We expect to be somewhere in here.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's going to be a very, very small on this,
right?
Not necessarily, I mean, I don't know, like, if you're, if you're...
Well, PF is gonna be happy, you're gonna detend them.
Yeah, but one, I mean, one mutation can, I mean, most mutations won't affect PF, but many mutations can, but again...
But the point is that they'll be selected already, so we're saying, we're giving this in the context of their selection of PF.
Yes, yes.
That what I, so all I'm saying, what I'm trying to say is, this is our context, we think is happening anyway, nobody's, neither of us is questioning that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the point is, based on PF, how we've been moving around.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, so then the point is, we assume that there's some additional effect.
On fitness, yeah.
Okay, on fitness based on the concentration-based effect on one minus PF.
But so to have an effect on fitness, you need to have an effect on PF. If a mutation tends to not change PF at all, then it will not change fitness at all.
So what I'm trying to say here, okay, is that this sort of relationship will lead to a direct selection on this very, very small tail. Okay, so the problem here is when you're selecting on PF.
So let's assume that, imagine that all mutations would be a peak, like would be like a sharp peak at zero. Then it means that all mutations are completely neutral. So because what we see within proteins is actually...
Well, can I say one thing just to see if this sums up? So here, basically, in the probability of folding,
right,
are not affecting fitness, right?
I mean...
Based on this, forgetting about this, just based on this, you evolve to the point where small fluctuations, right, in the probability of folding don't tend to affect fitness. That doesn't say there's going to be mutations that have a big effect, yes. Right, but the point is...
So, I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think most mutations, I mean, it's actually just given by this. Most mutations will change fitness exactly as a function of this plot tells us. So, say a quarter of the mutations will actually improve stability and, say, fitness, and three quarter of the mutations will decrease, some by a small extent, some by a larger extent.
Talking about the shape of the curve.
Yeah, but I'm not sure about that because...
These fluctuate, so what I'm saying is that these fluctuations here...
Can be pretty large,
okay.
I mean...
Are going to be here. They're going to be covered here.
I mean
you will equilibrate. I mean, the thing is that these are equilibrated. I mean, you will equilibrate to the point where that is true.
So, I mean, what I have in mind, but maybe it's not right, is that proteins basically live on the edge. They
marginal stability.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is all that this is saying. This is saying is that proteins are marginally stable, right?
I'm not sure because this is delta delta G, so it doesn't tell you anything about the delta G itself. So let's say if the delta G is...
But you did agree that the delta G has an effect on the delta G.
A small effect, yeah, very small effect. And the reason is quite simple, is that the more optimized you are, so the lower the delta G, the more you have to lose, basically.
So that's the
source of the relationship. But I mean, I would say that most proteins have a delta G. I would say, I mean, like 6 to 10 is probably a good stability. And so if you are at 6 and your delta is 2, you go to 4. You will gain a substantial. Not many mutations are beyond 2. I agree. But few mutations are. But then if you look at disordered regions. So this is interior, this is surface, and this, I would expect that disorder, I exaggerated a little bit, but would be like even more narrow around zero. And then, so for the mutation in the interior, many mutations can affect the stability to a large extent. because mutations are like maybe like a quarter to half the delta delta g is quarter to half the delta g. But here, the delta delta g will be a tenth of the delta g on average. So that.
So that is what you just said to me is entirely redundant to the fact that disordered regions and an average protein tend to evolve faster.
Exactly, yes. That's exactly redundant to that.
But the question we're asking is how they respond to higher concentrations.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is a different question. So the question of how they respond to higher concentrations is here.
But if they don't affect, if stability has only a marginal effect on those, then misfolding doesn't, so it's just to say that misfolding should be really a side problem for these regions. They should not be subject to the problem of misfolding in general. So the idea of using the other region is that they decouple the conservation from the folding.
That's true. Okay. And also your slides already agree that even if I don't know if you can want to check it, but I mean even I think this is this conservation?
Yeah.
Okay. So these guys are always lower than those guys.
Yes, exactly. That yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So even at high concentrations that's true.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So everything you're saying is just saying disordered regions tend to be above ordered regions. Okay,
yeah,
so I'm saying it's redundant to that. But the question is, how does it respond?
Yeah, to concentration. Yeah.
To concentration. So, but the question is in this tail, right? So the question is, I'm agreeing that disorder. So I'm saying that all of what I'm saying agrees that disorder is going to be less likely to affect stability much, right? And that there's the PF, right? But we're also saying that the direct PF is not a problem. So what I'm saying is that the tail, right? So basically this, whatever contribution disordered regions make to the PF is still gonna be
let's assume one thing, because this is what I'm assuming in all this. Let's assume that this is not a distribution, but it is exactly zero. So disordered region never, ever affects stability at all.
I disagree.
No, but let's assume for a second. Let's assume for a second that this is true. And now think about what to expect then. If that was true, what would we expect in terms of this plot?
If disorder was zero.
Yeah, if disorder was zero.
So
if disorder was zero and we would still see a correlation, we could state that this correlation is not due to misfolding.
Okay. So I'm trying to get this right. What I'm trying to say is that this is ordered. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The question I'm trying to get is.
So for disorder, I guess it would be just flat.
I'm gonna do KF. It's a constant. Okay. So what I would argue is that disordered okay, is that the multiplier might be different for K, you know, KD, and it says KO. So the multiplier is different, the scale is different. Right, so this is KO and this is KDF, right? So we rescale the two lines, but they're still a linear relationship.
So I'm not sure I get it.
So what I'm saying is, if concentration times one times the probability of folding, let's see. I'm not sure, I'm not positive if this entirely works. But basically what I'm trying to say is if we can break down, I'm not totally sure if it is, but we're sort of trying to break this down anyway. So break down the contribution to the probability of folding into a component of disordered and ordered.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that breakdown into the composition is these k's, that is, they're contributing differentially. So that means they're going to scale differently to fitness. Okay, but the relationship, the linear relationship, so that's going to mean then that they're lower or higher, whichever graph you're looking at, they're lower or higher, so the k's shift.
Well, I guess to me it would change the slope because, let's assume again, for example, that PF is zero for disordered regions, then we would have something like this. So whatever, I mean, you can explore any sequence, your fitness will be constant. Right. Because
so in the extreme, this is zero. So in the extreme, it's, well.
But so then
so in the extreme, so it's zero. So when you're saying zero, right, you're saying K is zero. Okay, which means, you know, you're saying that the proportion explained by this is zero, and there is, it doesn't even make sense to draw the graph.
But then if it's very small.
Right, because you can't, basically you can't go up on this graph.
Yeah.
Right,
exactly.
So there's no point
to
zero, but
yeah.
the point is more as you're changing this, right? So what we're agreeing on is that as you change disordered regions, they're going to have a smaller effect on the probability of folding. Okay, so
yeah.
The proportional is different, but what I'm saying is that the linear.
I mean, sure. If you affect the probability of folding, it will be affect. I mean, the consequence will be the same. I agree. That I totally agree. But I guess the underlying assumption, which I didn't make very clear, was that PF. We assume, the underlying assumption was that PF is zero, even if it's not correct. I agree, it's not correct, but it's closer to zero than it is for ordered region. I think this is.
But the point here is that with this argument, is that close to zero doesn't matter.
Close to zero doesn't matter.
Yep.
So, but this I still don't get. But.
So because. Whatever the proportion is, it's just contributing to a different. It's just putting these on a different scale, but the relationship.
So let's say, I mean,
same.
to like speak with your hands. Let's say you are a protein, and you have a domain and a disordered region, and the disordered region can like affect the folding of the domain, but with a probability that is much lower than mutations within the domain itself. So if misfolding is the limiting factor for the if the fitness of that, so you do a simulation and you accept or reject a mutation as a function of the total number of misfolded species. So actually we could just like use a scheme like this scheme from whatever. You accept or reject a mutation with a probability that is proportional to the number of misfolded molecules.
Yeah.
So you will tend to accept mutations for disordered regions much more often because they do not create
Yeah, and that's the scale, so that's arguing that they're above order, which we both agree is true.
No, but also, like in terms of the speeds, I mean, in the actually.
So look.
No, so.
So I can agree with what you just said.
Yeah.
Right. You tend, if it's all constant, you tend to do it, right?
Yeah.
So now just add in the multiplier of concentration.
Yes.
Okay, so this mutation has yay deleterious effect, right? So basically, if we do this, you know, we have mutation one, which is ordered, right? And how are we doing it? We're saying it has delta, we're saying it has a negative fitness effect, yeah? S, mm-hmm. at a given concentration.
Yeah.
Okay, and so let's say that's the average effect, right? And now we're saying that the disorder, okay, has lower effect.
Sorry, hold on. So let's go. Maybe we can continue tonight at the barbecue because
okay, yeah,
I'm not sure that we. I think we would need a day or something.